This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
How goes the State of the Union? On today's program, we feature excerpts from a major speech by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz on deficit reduction and common sense. The ink was hardly dry on the massive compromise federal tax bill when Republican leaders restarted their call for spending cuts in the new Congress to close the deficit. But Professor Stiglitz sets the record straight in his speech before the Roosevelt Institute. He says that the main cause of the deficits is the recession, which premature deficit reduction would cause to deteriorate further. He also offers us a way to rebuild our economy, which would also fight the increasing maldistribution of wealth in this country by taxing the rich, reducing the military budget, and investing in our cities, our infrastructure, and new technologies to increase our productive capacities to increase economic growth. And now, Professor Stiglitz.
Deficit reduction is not an end in itself. As one thinks about the issues of austerity, of deficit reduction, one has to think about it in the context of the problems that the United States is facing today. The economy is not recovered. And I'm afraid if we don't have a second round of stimulus, if we don't address the problems in the mortgage market, if we don't address the problems in our banking system, that the recovery will remain anemic. Growth will be low. The economics behind deficit reduction in the short run, there is very little doubt that austerity measures will impede the recovery, that they will contribute to the prolongation of the economic downturn. Ireland, Spain, Greece, Latvia have all shown that those austerity measures did lead to significant economic downturns. Last May, the Spanish Parliament passed their deficit reduction package, their austerity package. The next day, the bond markets downgraded their bonds. Not because they didn't believe that they would fulfill those austerity measures, but because they believed that they would. They knew that those austerity measures would lead to lower growth. Lower growth would actually impede the recovery, would exacerbate problems in a country where already there was 20% unemployment. The austerity agenda reminds me of medieval bloodletting. The view is that, well, yes, it's painful, but in the end, it'll be good for the patient. We know what happened. It wasn't so good for the patients. They usually died. But the answer was, as they got sicker and sicker, the doctor said, we just haven't let enough blood. They still have a little blood left. Let's do it a little bit more. And we all know what eventually happened. If you read the chairman's preliminary draft of the deficit commission, it's replete with arbitrarily chosen numbers. Half of the deficit reduction should come out of military, half out of domestic. There should be a cap of 21% on the size of the government. Numbers that are pulled out of nowhere without any reference to social goals, economic analysis, they're just numbers pulled out of the air. I'm not going to directly address those particular numbers. As I say, I don't think anybody can because they are totally arbitrary. But I want to emphasize that what is missing in the Simpson-Bowles report is any sense of what the objectives that we ought to be striving for. And as I said, repeat, deficit reduction is not an end in itself. As we look at the debt, we ought to look at what we're doing with the spending, and that's in particular assets. If you increase public investments, high return investments, you can actually have crowding in the private sector. Yes, what was the most constructive investment at the end of the last century? It was investments in the internet. Those were only made possible as a result of government investment in creating the internet. It wasn't the private sector that created the internet, it was the government investments that created it. And that government investment then crowded in a huge investment in internet and a whole set of technologies. Same thing is true in biotechnology. As we think about this issue of deficit reduction, we have to be very sensitive to the fact that our economy is still weak, and therefore we have timing is important. No matter what we think about deficit reduction, any actions we take have to be sensitive to the fact that the economic downturn is continuing. And again, on the basis of the preliminary remarks of the chairman of the Deficit Commission, they are much more optimistic than I am and than almost all economists. They start having deficit reduction in the next year, 2 years. I hope our economy recovers that robustly. The likelihood of that is close to zero. So they will be contributing to the downturn. We are actually, in the United States, lucky right now because we have underinvested for 20 years in the public sector, and that means we have a lot of high-return investment opportunities. We can borrow at extraordinary low interest rates, 0 to 2.5%. Any firm that could borrow at those low interest rates and has the kind of high-return investment opportunities that we have, that passed up on those investment opportunities would be foolish. If we had invested in levees in New Orleans, we would have saved a few billion dollars of spending, would have saved hundreds of billions of dollars. So these investments pay for themselves. They lower the debt because they grow the economy and that generates tax revenue, and they increase the GDP. They increase sustainability. In the United States, there's been an enormous increase in inequality in recent years. It's not just inequality. The middle class is not doing well. Median income has declined by some 5% over the past decade and was even in decline before the recession. Poverty has increased from under 12% in 1999 to over 14% today. The incidence of Americans who are suffering from food insecurity, that have to give up a meal because they can't afford a meal on a regular basis in the United States is close to 1 out of 7. That the richest country in the world, that a 1 out of 7 Americans face this problem of food insecurity is astounding. As you start looking at particular groups, median income of males with only a high school education has decreased 13% in the last decade, but over almost a quarter since 1980. So these are real changes in particular socioeconomic groups. The upper 1% of Americans accounted for an average of some 22% of the nation's taxed income during 2004 to 2008, and 65% of the income growth during the Bush expansion was captured by the top 1% of the families. The second context is we have to think about the source of the deficit. The major source of the increase of the deficit is the economic recession. Anything that exacerbates, prolongs that downturn is counterproductive. The other areas are military, health, are the things that we ought to be focusing on. What is a deficit reduction agenda? And I divide that into three areas. The first is growth-enhancing deficit reduction measures. So there are some things, some ways that we can reduce the deficit and increase the economy. The first, though, actually entails increasing the size of government. And that is increased spending and high-yield government investment. And that should really be the beginning because we've underinvested in the public sector. The second, which is reduced spending on corporate welfare, because that distorts the economy and increases inequities. And there are three categories that I spend some time talking about. One is subsidies to agriculture, which have a whole set of global ramifications, including increasing the incidence of poverty among the poorest people in the developing world. Secondly, subsidies to producers of fossil fuels, which contribute to environmental problems, global warming. And the third is reducing the excessive payments to the pharmaceutical companies, an item which is close to $1 trillion over a decade, which is a major component of why America's healthcare costs are larger than those of other countries. The third category has not gotten as much attention in any public discussion, which is better auctioning and management of government-owned natural resources and other assets. We have been engaged in massive giveaways of assets that the government owns. We give away to the broadcasters spectrum that's extraordinarily valuable. We then have to, the public has to buy it back to get messages about the political process. In minerals and a whole set of other areas, we are engaged in massive giveaways, timber and so forth. The second broad category I call towards a fairer and more efficient tax system. This is important. We're going to think about a lot of thinking about increasing taxes, tax revenue. We ought to think about how we do it in a way that it increases equity in our society and efficiency. That we ought to take advantage of this fact that I described before of the increase in inequality in our society. the upper 1% that's getting about 20%. Their effective tax rate is actually relatively low. If we increase the effective tax rate on this group by 5 percentage points and kept everybody else the same, that would, over a decade, get close, depending on the estimate, somewhere around $1 trillion, $1.5 trillion. And in a sense, this is the only group that we ought to be focusing on. 1%, 2%, I don't want to give a particular number, but this is where the sources of deficit reduction ought to lie. Secondly, we ought to be thinking about creating a fair tax system. To me, it makes no sense that somebody who earns their money by speculation, attacking Greece or other form of attacking, ought to be taxed at lower rates than somebody who works for their income. You know, this is the idea that it's more important to speculate than to work, and we ought to encourage speculation, is something that has no economic base and is inequitable. So it distorts our economy and it creates inequities. One of the things that should be very clear is that we should eliminate the preferential treatment of capital gains, preferential treatment of dividends. Interesting point, when in the 2001-2003 tax cuts we gave that preferential treatment, did it lead to better real investment in our economy? No. It led to the problems that we've seen since then. It's not like this led to real investments that increased the productivity of the economy. The third category in the tax agenda is a growth-oriented corporate and individual income tax system. If we want to use the tax system to increase investment, we won't do that by lowering the corporate income tax. No evidence that lowering the corporate income tax is going to generate more investment broadly. You can have temporary investment tax credits that might do that, but not the broad-based lowering of the tax rate that the Simpson-Bowles proposals suggest. The fourth item of the tax agenda is what I call the generalized Henry George principle. I mentioned before that it talks about land, but what is the other major inelastically supplied resource? It's our natural resources. The oil, gas, other natural resources don't disappear when you tax them. Now, of course, it takes resources to extract them. But the rents associated with these, what economists call rents, ought to be taxed at as close to 100% as possible. And one can design tax structures that do that. We don't do that. The fifth is the generalized polluter pay principle. We should be taxing carbon emissions and other environmental externalities. That by itself will raise more than $1 trillion if we did that well. Finally, the polluter pay principle says that you ought to tax those who pollute the world. Was discussed in the context of toxic waste. Well, our financial sector polluted the entire world with toxic mortgages. And I think we all understand that they have imposed large externalities on the rest of us, costs that are in the trillions of dollars. Most other countries around the world are discussing how to correct the distortions associated with the financial sector. Financial sectors are extraordinarily important. No economy can function without them. So this is not a question about being anti the financial sector. It's about restructuring the financial sector to do what it ought to do. And it's clear they didn't do what it ought to do. So this is a pro-financial sector, but a redirecting the financial sector to make it, encourage it to do what it's supposed to do. And other countries have been discussing a bonus tax, a financial transaction tax, a taxes, a bank rescue fund to try to discourage excess leverage, discourage too-big-to-fail banks. All of these ought to be on the table. Basically, we're not in the Simpson-Bowles proposal. One financial tax that we already have is there's a tax on every credit card transaction. But it's a tax that doesn't go to public purpose. It goes to the credit card companies and the banks. And it's a significant amount. It's an amount that goes anywhere from 0.6% to 2.4% on the merchant, passed on to all of us, to all the customers, on every transaction. And what I suggest is that let's cap it, like many other countries have done, and let's make sure that a larger fraction of that actually goes to public purpose. And the final category of deficit reduction growth proposals are a careful scrutiny of non-growth enhancing expenditures. And there are two subcategories within here. One of them is the military expenditures. The issue here is not our security. We are spending hundreds of billions of dollars of weapons that don't work against enemies that don't exist. It may not be news to the Defense Department, but the Cold War has been over for about 20 years. And that ought to have led to a restructuring of what we do. Who is the enemy that we're spending as much as the whole rest of the world put together? It's clear that there is ample room for cuts. And the final example is more efficient assistance to the state and local governments. The way we do it, much of the benefits of the assistance we give through tax exemption actually goes to increasing the regressivity of our taxes. So let me just conclude and say the issue facing the country is, in the end, in a sense, not economic, but political. From an economic perspective, I hope what I've shown is that we can easily meet the deficit reduction goals as the long list of proposals that I've brought out here. The reason that we have the myriad of the distortions and inequities that have been identified is because the influence of special interest groups, who, so far at least, have been willing to sacrifice the national interest in their pursuit of their own interests. If they continue to do so, then the only way that we will be able to achieve these goals is at the expense of those who are less politically powerful. If we proceed to achieve the deficit reduction goals on their backs, it will only contribute to the growing cynicism and skepticism about America's democratic political processes and contribute to the lack of participation in the electoral process. Economics is the science of trade-offs. Normally, one can, for instance, achieve greater equity only at the expense of a loss of efficiency. We can achieve deficit reduction only by cutting back on expenditures or raising taxes. America is, as I've suggested in an ironic sense, lucky. Because of its underinvestment in the public sector and the extraordinary low interest rates and the vast underutilization of human and other resources, it can increase public investment, increase output and employment, and simultaneously reduce the long-term national debt. Because of its distorted and unfair tax system, it can reduce some of these distortions and inequities, with the result that growth and efficiency will be promoted at the same time that the inequities are reduced. The country does face a critical choice to continue on the current course, slightly modified, which might succeed in reducing the long-term national debt, but at great cost to the long-term economic and social fabric, or to embark on an alternative agenda that this kind of discussion proposes.
And you were listening to Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz on deficit reduction versus economic growth.
We've taken all you give. It's getting hard to make a living. Mr. President, the pity on working man. We ain't asking.
The song was Mr. President by Randy Newman, an ode to Governor Huey Long, who mounted a populist challenge to President Roosevelt. And now, Stop the Lies, Wall Street Fat Cats Flip Public Service Workers the Bird, a new mini-documentary by Brave New Films and Robert Greenwald.
Layoff notices will soon be in the mail for nearly 900 state workers.
The news, hundreds of state workers will start to be laid off in waves.
According to past estimates, up to 10,000 jobs.
We are talking about thousands of layoffs.
The mayor is playing hardball by putting more jobs on the chopping block.
My name is LaShawn Wiggers. I'm from Southern California. I was a child care director for the city of Los Angeles for about 5 years of a facility which had 50 preschoolers and 50 school-age children. I guess it was about February. All child care was brought into a meeting to let us know that there were possibly going to be layoffs. Within the city, there's 26 state-licensed child care centers. What they did was they closed all but two. So 24 sites are now closed. The fact that they're not going to be a part of my life every day, and the fact that I'm not going to have contact, and to make sure that they're safe every day, that's my main concern, because I know some of the situation of the parents. They're not going to be able to afford some of the child care centers that are out there. So for me, that's tough.
Thousands of more L.A. city workers could soon face layoffs.
We're talking about librarians, child care workers.
We're teaching the children of the future. And for us to have lost our jobs or for us to have been laid off, it's like what we do is not important. Only banks or only executives or only people who are higher up who kind of look down on us, they're the ones who still get to keep their jobs.
My name is Joe Wisnowski. I live in Pickerington, Ohio. I'm an equipment operator for Columbus Airport. I'm a father of two children, a son in college and a sophomore in high school. When this all started, we went into wage freezes and no raises. Last year, 2009, we've had 17 people laid off. I fear that my job is under attack every day based on the economy, and the politicians are after public employees and our services that we have. I think I would have a great concern if I would be laid off from public employment. Financially, it would be a great burden on trying to provide for my son's college. All these high CEOs and Wall Streeters getting bonuses on our tax dollars, and the thought of the government coming after public employees saying that they're the ones of the cause of this. If we start going and attacking the public services and cutting them away, there's people who won't have that service that they need greatly out there.
My name is Robert Bonds. I work for the city of Detroit as a parking meter collections assistant. We basically collect the money out of the parking meters to generate revenue for the city of Detroit. Early on working for the city, I never worried about my pension or if I would have a job tomorrow or next week. And over the years, I've seen more and more people get laid off or have their pay cut. I worry about it now. Every day I get up and go to work, I'm waiting for somebody to tell me, have you heard, they're going to cut our department, it's hard. The fact that someone's sitting in an office somewhere dealing in derivatives, whatever that is, gets
millions of dollars in a bonus on top of what they're being paid is obscene.
I don't think public employees have gotten a fair shake within the media.
We contribute to our pension, so it's not like I'm going to get rich off of my pension. And I think a lot of times we're used as scapegoats.
I hate to see it because, you know, what is that teaching my son? You know, you can work hard, you go to college, get your degree, and it's all out of your hands. Your success is based on somebody sitting in an office somewhere on Wall Street, you know, how your life turns out. And that's not what I want him to believe this is all about.
This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.